This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's great to have you with us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. One of the topics we cover rather regularly on our Main Street show is education. We look at it from lots of different points of view, and we also use something that has become, I think, pretty valuable for us and for our listeners. This is the Cutting Ed Podcast. It's a collaboration of North Dakota United, Prairie Public, and entrepreneur Ted Dinter-Smith. The Cutting Ed Podcast looks at what is new in education and what's working, you know, so it's worth listening to. And teachers will tell you that students have different ways of learning. The one-size-fits-all practices of the past are being replaced by approaches that recognize that there are different personalities and different abilities with different students. This week's Cutting Ed Podcast features Lene Lease, the personalized learning coordinator for the New Rockford Cheyenne Schools. The school district recently started a personalized learning academy, which gives students study options and allows them more freedom to collaborate. The goal is better outcomes. Here's Cutting Ed Podcast host, Tom Gerhardt.
Where did the idea come from? When did you implement?
The Personalized Learning Academy pretty much came from our school wanting to give our kids more voice and choice and more options in their learning. I'm actually certified through AASA's Personalized Learning Cohort, so I'm very passionate and excited about this. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to be a part of this program in our school. It's an opt-in program, and the kids were able to choose 3 or 4 courses that they wanted to be a part of. And an instructor is there one period of the day. They float in, float out, acting as a coach. So the students take on their own learning. They're the driver of their education. They come in, very informal setting. They're allowed snacks, drinks, whatever, and they're allowed to visit quietly with one another. Collaborating is a huge part of what we do. They choose their course they feel like working on. They work on their own. We use Edgenuity as a platform. And when the bell rings, they often don't move. It's funny when a sub comes in because they're like, the bell rings and these kids don't even flinch. They just keep on rolling, which is fun. And when they get tired of one course, they just switch gears and say, I'm going to work on my English now. And the kids really are enjoying it. It's a nice thing to be a part of.
So where's the accountability built in? People might question if they have this time and they're advocating for their own education. How do you keep track of the measurables?
Edgenuity has all that built in for you. Every day I look at a dashboard and I can see who's behind pace, who's on pace, or ahead of pace. If a student is behind pace, we like them to work at the table in the center of the classroom where the teacher is right there acting as a coach, guiding the instruction the entire time. Mastery of content is our goal. So anything below an 80%, the kids do redos or retakes. And funny thing, they don't want their grade below the 80%. And oftentimes they'll say, can you reset my quiz? I want to do it again. I want to get a better score. It's a rigorous program. They'll tell you they're working hard, but it's fantastic. I'm anxious to see the data at the end of the year.
Why is personalized learning so important in this day and age?
I think right now we are recognizing the need for students to have a voice and choice in their learning. It's easy for me to stand in the front of the classroom and lecture for 40 minutes and give you an assignment. But a lot of times now we're realizing in that 40-minute period, a student probably picked up 5-10 minutes of what you were actually saying, and they tend to tune out. This way the kids are learning. They know this is in their hands.
And we've seen data that after testing 3 or 6 months down the road, you know, kids retain very little. But in this type of authentic learning experience, the idea is it sticks with them.
Yeah. And the kids will say that. They said, I used to learn it, and then after the test, I would dump the information. Now I'm hanging on to it. I mean, I don't think they know really what's going on, because I've often said, why do you think it's different? And they said, I don't know. I think because nobody's telling it to me. I have to get it.
I can tell you're pretty excited about this. It's new here in New Rockford, Cheyenne, but there seems to be a buzz. I know even the governor recognized the district at his innovation conference.
I am excited about it. I love seeing the kids' excitement. I love that they're coming to school. They're happy to be a part of it. That we now have kids asking, when can I get in? So second semester, we're looking forward to some new faces joining us.
Other districts that are looking to model what's happening here in New Rockford, Cheyenne, what advice do you have for anyone else looking to implement a similar personalized learning academy?
we did an interview process, which gave it a bigger formality. Mr. Bombach and I interviewed the students together, and they had to take it very seriously. They had to understand that this is not an easier path. There was some of that misunderstanding that maybe this is going to be easier when in fact it's a very rigorous path. So the kids have to be ready to take the learning on themselves. And the teacher has to be ready to take a step back and act as a coach. I often say if you had a football player on the team that was struggling with passing, you're not just going to sit there and let him figure it out. You're going to be right there guiding him. And that's how our instruction is. Instead of standing up front delivering instruction, we're at their side guiding. Tell me about what you're learning. Tell me more. Asking the questions, having more discussions with the kids.
And in terms of sort of infrastructure here at the school, has there been a big change from top to bottom in terms of teachers, in terms of scheduling and things like that? Or has it been a really fairly smooth implementation?
The eighth grade English teacher comes to the play one period a day. So the kids know, like, period five, if I'm struggling in my English or I need help with a quiz or I didn't understand a certain concept, they know period five, I can report to the PLA and that teacher will be there to help me. They don't have to work on their English when the PLA teacher's in there, though. They can work on what they feel like. And a neat analogy is when I'm sitting at home reading, I'm just really involved in my novel, and a bell rings and, oh, I got to switch gears and I got to balance the checkbook. You know, that's not real life, you know, and that's what we're trying to give to our kids. If you're in the middle of it and you're doing great and you're on a roll, keep rolling. Don't let the bell ringing stop you. Just keep on going.
Tell us what you've been hearing from the students that have opted in to the PLA.
The students that have opted in, I'm not sure what they like the most. I think they like independence and the responsibility of going out and getting it. They also like a simple fact that, you know, they have late nights. They're busy kids. They like the idea that if I have to be on the bus for 2 hours tonight, I don't have to worry about an assignment due tomorrow because I know I can do it the next day. Or I know if I don't feel well, I got the weekend to catch up.
And you mentioned in a rural community, the flexibility for travel, no matter what the student's involvement is, that this fills a lot of gaps too.
It does. One little girl, she went to Colorado and she's like, I'm just going to use my hotspot on my phone and I'll, you know, stay on pace. And she did. They like being in control of that, having a say in all that and being in charge.
And the idea is to prepare students beyond high school and beyond college.
Exactly.
If that's their choice.
Absolutely. And I have two children of my own in college, and I see this as a great way to prepare them for the organization, the planning out your time schedules, what you need to study, what you need to do first, what you need to do last. Just the responsibility of it is very helpful. Another thing is they have to take notes. That in itself, for my daughter, was a huge learning curve at UND. She didn't really know how to take notes. She wasn't sure what to do in terms of taking notes. And these kids have to do it. And they have to, once a week, they report to the academy teacher and they go through their notes. And that's how the notes guide their conversations with the teacher. I think it's fantastic giving those kids that voice and choice in their education. I encourage all schools to give it a whirl. It's been successful for us.
Lene Lease, Personalized Learning Academy Coordinator at New Rockford Cheyenne. Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Cutting Ed Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Cutting Ed Podcast host Tom Gerhart talking with Lene Lease about the Personalized Learning Academy she coordinates for the New Rockford Cheyenne School District. You can access Cutting Ed Podcasts at ndunited.org. Coming up on Main Street, Madeline reviews another new movie and the recent Academy Awards.
Hey, teachers, no need to brave the cold for great professional development. Join Prairie Public's weekly web chats from the cozy, convenient comfort of your home or classroom. This free series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help other teachers maximize their teaching power. Chats are every Tuesday and Thursday, and continuing education credit is available. Go to prairiepublic.org to learn more.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. And Matt, this was a big week because the Academy Awards were also at the start of our week.
That's right. And I saw a movie that was up for a couple of awards and won one, and that's If Beale Street Could Talk, which is finally kind of working its way through theaters. It did play in Grand Forks a while back, but it never got to Fargo and didn't get to a lot of cities in North Dakota. So please check your listings for that. But I did finally see it. This is the follow-up by writer-director Barry Jenkins, who 2 years ago, you know, the best picture went to Moonlight, which he directed, a phenomenal motion picture. And this is his adaptation of James Baldwin's famous novel, If Beale Street Could Talk. And it takes place in the 70s in New York, so it's a period piece about a young black man played by Stephen James. He plays the young black man whose name is Fonny, and he is accused by a woman of rape, and he's incarcerated. And we go through the steps of, is he guilty, is he not guilty? His pregnant girlfriend, played by Kiki Lane, in a very good performance. She has really soulful eyes in the close-ups. You know, her and her mother, played by Regina King, who just got the Supporting Actress Oscar, are trying desperately to get him out of jail, to convince the woman, that's not who raped you. There's somebody else. You've a mistaken identity in the police lineup. So really, it's a film about love. The two young protagonists are in love, and Barry Jenkins shoots close-ups of these actors so wonderfully, Doug. If you want to know what two people look like in love, watch the close-ups in this film because it tells you everything you need to know. And Barry Jenkins, just like he did in Moonlight, lets scenes play out in kind of a leisurely, languid pace so we get the maximum impact of certain scenes between Kiki Lane and Stephen James or the mother played by Regina King. The film is told in flashbacks, so it's kind of flashback to how they met, how they got in this situation, and there's a lot of flashbacks going on, but I think that Jenkins, for the most part, makes it easy to follow the story. So he stays true to James Baldwin's words. Often through the film, we get a sense of actual prose lifted from James Baldwin's novel that's done in narration, and I think he was pretty true to a novel that's kind of hard to film. I overall like this film. Didn't get really any Best Picture nomination type momentum, but it is a good film that I think people should see. And I think it stays true to James Baldwin's message of young love and also the alternate theme of incarceration of young black men in America.
Now, I have not read James Baldwin's novel, so this title kind of confuses me. When I see Beale Street, I think of Memphis.
Yeah, so the title is a metaphor for any street in America that African Americans might live on. And that's explained in the very first scene of the film, why the book is titled that book. Yes, it's in New York City, but it's a metaphor for any street that anyone might grow up on and suffer, you know, poverty, trying to get out of poverty, that kind of thing. So that's really what the title means. And it's explained to the audience very early on.
So this is a bit of a message film, though.
That's a good question, Doug. I liked how Jenkins did this because really it's a film about two people in love trying to stay together while he's behind bars and she's pregnant. And so that complicates matters with both families. But, you know, the message of incarceration of young black men, mistaken identity, and there's stories littered through time about these kind of things. It's a part of the story, but it's not an overwhelming part of the story. And I think what Jenkins does when he goes down the road in the film of how he utilizes that message, he does it in a very subtle way. Spike Lee would bludgeon you over the head with the message, and that's his style. Good for him. It worked in Black Klansman at the end. Jenkins is much more subtle, and he does it in more of a lyrical, cinematic way than Spike Lee does. You may have your preferences of how that's done. I like the way Jenkins did it, and if Beale Street Could Talk, even though I think Black Klansman overall is a slightly better film and much more entertaining and funny. This is not a funny film at all, but I did like it for the most part. A little surprised it didn't get a little more Oscar attention than the two nominations it got, which were screenplay and supporting actress, because it's definitely one of the 15 or so best films I saw this year.
Well,
for 2018, when I say this year.
Let's talk about this in terms of the Oscars, because it wasn't that long ago there were pretty loud complaints about the whiteness of the Oscars. And now we've got, I think, some real push from people of color.
So if you saw the show, not only did the production designer from Black Panther, it was a black woman, also the costume designer from Black Panther. So Ryan Coogler, the director of that film, went out of his way to hire people of color on that film. So we saw a lot of diversity on Oscar night. At the end of Oscar night, if that's what you're driving at next, we got Best Picture for Green Book. And there was kind of a thud with some people like Jordan Peele and Spike Lee who didn't like the movie. And then you have Octavia Spencer and Mahershala Ali up on the stage who were associated with the movie
and Moonlight.
And clearly liked the movie. Well, Ali was in Moonlight also, which is a very different film from Green Book. So I do think their efforts to expand the voting membership, get more minority voting voters, more women voters has worked for the most part. What I liked on Oscar night too, Doug, is several of the short films that won, female filmmakers up there.
Mm-hmm.
Period, End of Sentence, that film about the menstrual cycle that won an Academy Award. And it was kind of funny when they said that, I can't believe you won an Oscar about a film like this. And so that's great to see. But Green Book is a touchstone. It's sort of a controversial lightning rod, as we've seen since Sunday night. And I've got some theories on that if you want me to expand on those.
Well, I have seen Green Book, and I actually really liked the movie.
I
have since read about how Don Shirley's family is not very happy with it. And it has been referred to as a white savior movie, which is, you know, the racist white guy sort of becomes enlightened.
It's also been referred to as reverse driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah,
the white
exactly.
The white guy's driving the car this time. And Spike Lee famously said, every time I'm up against a film with somebody driving, I lose. Because Do the Right Thing wasn't even nominated the year Driving Miss Daisy won. So that was kind of funny as well when he said that. I think how you view Green Book is what you bring from your background as a person going into that theater, your biases. And certainly it's a film that has two great performances. Do I think it should have won Best Picture? No. But I see both sides of this. It is an entertaining movie with two good performances. I don't think it's worthy of a Best Picture win. But I also see the side of an African-American watching that movie. Even though Mahershala Ali is great in the movie, the Viggo Mortensen character kind of has to teach him what it means to be black.
And has to protect him.
Yeah, so he protects him. And maybe that's how it happened. You know, it's based on a true story. The problem, Doug, is it's based on stories from the Viggo Mortensen character to his son, who's a co-screenwriter.
Yes.
It's not really based on what Don Shirley said. So where's the truth? I don't know. And I don't know if anybody knows. And that's really the problem. Does Don Shirley's family know? I don't know that either.
Well, they say that the tour was to historically black colleges, not to places that were highly segregated in the South. But they also, say they were never consulted.
They were not consulted. This is strictly a screenplay from the point of view of the Viggo Mortensen character.
And the Green Book was used.
It was used. So I think that's where the problems come in. This is going to be a film that's going to be talked about for years, just like Crash was. Whereas, should this have won Best Picture? And a lot of people are saying it's the worst film to win Best Picture since Crash. Justin Chang for the LA Times wrote a huge op-ed about this, saying that's his view. Again, it's what you bring to the theater. To me, it feels more like a Driving Miss Daisy, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner film. And those are films about racism or race relations that are geared toward white audiences. As you remember, Doug, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is a film now that a lot of black people look at and cringe.
Yeah.
Whereas In the Heat of the Night, I still think holds up. In the Heat of the Night, which came out the same year as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, works because Poitier is really the protagonist in the film. Rod Steiger got the Oscar, but Poitier is a driving force in that movie. So this film does not feel like Moonlight. It feels a lot different than Moonlight, which won 2 years ago. I don't know what that says about the Academy. I have no idea the voting patterns. I don't know how close this vote was. I do invite people to see Green Book and don't just assume something based on something you haven't seen. But it is a film that's going to ignite controversy, I think, for years to come.
Well, let's talk about some of the other winners, because you weren't a fan of Roma, but the director, Alfonso Cuarón, took that Oscar.
Not a surprise that he won. I will say this. He is the only person in Oscar history who now has a directing Oscar, an editing Oscar for Gravity, and a cinematography Oscar. That is a unheard of triple threat that he has pulled off. So kudos to him. I was underwhelmed by the film. I don't think it's a great film. I've seen 500 better foreign language films in my life, but it is what it is. I think Cold War is a better film. I think Vice is a better film. I think Can You Ever Forgive Me is a better film, but that wasn't up for Best
that
Picture.
That was a great movie.
So The two lead acting Oscars, though, were interesting, Doug. Mahershala Ali winning in supporting, and Regina King for If Beale Street Could Talk, not surprises, though they were favored. Rami Malek has gained momentum, and I told you this.
Yeah.
He's been gaining momentum for a month now.
But he beat Christian Bale.
He did beat Christian Bale, and I think it's the wrong choice. I think history will judge it as the wrong choice. I think Academy voters got confused between their admiration of the band Queen and a average film about the band's lead singer. They're two different things, and I think eventually they got melded into one.
But it's a remarkable portrayal, isn't it? I mean, I've seen...
He is good. I don't have any problem with him being nominated, but he did not do any of the singing. Bradley Cooper did his own singing in A Star Is Born and really wasn't in contention ever.
But he brought down the house.
But he brought down the house.
So Lady Gaga.
I think Malek did... Here's what I say, Doug. Malek did a good imitation of Freddie Mercury. Christian Bale, however, transformed into Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney could study that to learn how to be Dick Cheney.
In a much more superior film. That's the problem I have with what they did. I also think, Doug, I'm going to just say this and put it out there. I think Malek won partly because he played a beloved figure, and Christian Bale played a figure that is not beloved by a lot of people in this country. And I think that had something to do with the voting. It shouldn't. It should be based on performance. But I do think that that had something to do with it.
Well, Malek also reminded the audience that he was a first-generation Egyptian.
And let me say, he played this Oscar campaign perfectly. He's a likable young man. He played the game perfectly. He comes off as friendly. He comes off as genuine. And I think that helped him toward this award, plus the fact that Freddie Mercury is now kind of a beloved figure, and Dick Cheney, depending on who you talk to, is not.
A first-generation American whose parents were from Egypt.
Egypt, yes.
Let's talk about Olivia Colman. She was a bit of a surprise, wasn't she? Wasn't Glenn Close sort of the odds on?
That was the shocker of the night. So this was thought to be Glenn Close's time, seventh nomination, never won, should have won for Fatal Attraction, and this would not have been an issue had she won for that film 31 years ago. This was a surprise, but I don't have a problem with it. I would have voted for Colman or Melissa McCarthy over Glenn Close. The Wife is a good film. It's a nice film, Doug, but I never walked out of the theater this summer when I saw The Wife at the Fargo Theater thinking, oh, there's Glenn Close's Oscar. She's good in the film, but I think in the end, the voters looked at the performance and were swayed by what Olivia Colman pulled off in that movie in The Favorite. So it was a shock. Glenn Close is now in that Peter O'Toole, Richard Burton category of 0-7, 0-8. I'm sure she'll get an honorary Oscar at a nice banquet here in 4 or 5 years. But it is what it is. It's a vote. The vote is taken. And no one is guaranteed an Oscar.
Well, The Favorite was a remarkable film in that it tells an interesting story in a different kind of way with three very strong women. Remarkable performances.
Great performances. Rachel Weisz could have won the supporting actress Oscar easily, but she's already won, and Regina King was a nice choice.
Let's go back to Black Panther for just a moment, though, because that won three Oscars. Now, none of the major ones, but still, it's a bit of a landmark film, isn't it?
It is. It became a cultural phenomenon worldwide, virtually an all-black cast. Much of the crew was black, as we see from the production designer and the costume designer, who both got Oscars. So it's a touchstone, I think. Is it the best Marvel film? No, I don't think it is. But sometimes a film catches that zeitgeist out there and it gets nominations. It won the three awards I thought it would win.
All right. Well, he'll be back, I'm sure of that.
and go see If Beale Street Could Talk if you have not seen it. Nice portrait of a James Baldwin novel.
I look forward to seeing it. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom will talk about some books for winter. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Senate committee is looking at a constitutional change that its supporters say would make it tougher to get an initiated constitutional measure on the ballot. Beulah Republican Senator Jessica Unruh is the main sponsor of the measure. It would raise the threshold for getting those measures put on the ballot from 4% of the state's electorate to 8%. It would also require that at least 50% of the signatures come from residents of each of the state's 53 counties. The petition has to be submitted at least 240 days in advance of the election, and it would require a 60% yes vote to take effect.
Changing our Constitution should be hard, and it should require some buy-in from the entire state.
The president of the North Dakota AFL-CIO testified against the bill. Waylon Hedegaard told reporters afterward.
4015 basically will take the will of the people and make it impossible for them to ever amend the Constitution. They put so many restrictions in it that it will make amending the Constitution through a ballot process impossible. And that's not what we need.
The Senate Government and Veterans Affairs Committee has not yet acted on the measure. The House has passed a resolution that would ensure North Dakota voters always have a say in amending the state's constitution. The resolution would require that any ballot measure seeking to amend the constitution must be voted on in the general election. Republican Representative Ben Koppelman says recent research shows that more voters go to the polls for general elections versus primary elections. Thus, more people would be voting on the amendments.
Being that the state constitution is an incredibly important framework for our state, that we should not take that amendment lightly, and we should try to set the system up in such a way where the most people can weigh in at an election if we're going to amend the constitution. So, Mr. Speaker, members of the Assembly, we would encourage a green vote.
The resolution was passed on a vote of 82 to 10. And a Bismarck lawmaker wants an interim legislative study about combining the state Parks and Recreation Department with the state Game and Fish Department. Republican Representative Rick Becker says the idea was suggested by a constituent.
A lot of states have a single department that covers both of what our Game and Fish and our Parks and Rec do. And so this resolution is simply for a study to look at it, see if it's feasible, to see if there indeed would be cost savings. And it's a great idea.
Becker says it also fits into Governor Burgum's plans for reinventing government. The study resolution was presented to a House committee on Thursday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On this week's Legislative Review, Assistant House Minority Leader Carla Rose Hansen of Fargo joins us to talk about the second part of the legislative session, including prospects for behavioral health and infrastructure funding, as well as what Democrats are expecting and hoping from the March revenue forecast. Legislative Review, 6:30 p.m. Central Time Friday here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio. And in our Bismarck studio, we've got root seller Sue Balcom, because it's time for Main Street Eats.
Thank you, Sue.
Actually, guys, it's time for Thinking Spring. Don't you agree?
Yes, I always think
please.
That. Yes, unless it's summer, then I want to definitely stay firmly in summer. And, you know, when you can't get out in the garden, you can still plan the garden. And that sometimes just involves a lot of reading and just remembering what it is you love about gardening. And I tell you, I have never talked to a gardener. I've never been able to get through the, what's a book that you would recommend before they say, Animal Vegetable Miracle. Just like, I can't get the whole question out.
Do you know what's amazing about that book? I think that was the first book I ever read that kind of kicked off my career in local foods.
Mm.
And I went to a farm-to-school conference as part of my job with the Ag Department back in probably 2010 or so. And I met Barbara Kingsolver because she was the keynote speaker.
Wow.
So here we are riding down this great big long elevator from a really tall hotel, things we don't have in North Dakota, by the way. And so it was a long ride down the elevator, and we're all chatting away, and we get down to the banquet hall, and we sit down, and the woman in the elevator that was chatting with us, just like we were her best friends, walks up to the front of the stage, and there it is. It's Barbara Kingsolver. And I'm like, oh, nuts, I could have had her autograph my book. But it's a great book about how she discovered local foods and how they bought a place that had probably less than favorable soil in the southern states and just started canning and baking and paying attention to the food they eat. So if you've never, and she's an easy read. She's a She's a good author. She's written a lot of other books. I would highly recommend that if you've never read anything about local foods or foodies, food systems, that kind of thing.
And the full title is Animal, Vegetable, Miracle, A Year of Food Life by Barbara Kingsolver.
Thank you. That is absolutely right. So once you're on board with Ashley and Doug and I when it comes to food, then you want to move on to some other things like there's a local book that I'm reading right now. It was written by Gabe Brown. He lives northeast of Bismarck. You can see his place from the interstate. And I met him a long time ago when I worked at the Mandan News, and I did an article on bull grooming. He had a bull groomer come in when he was still selling bulls, and this guy would, you know, trim the hooves and give him a little haircut. And
this makes him more attractive to the heifers?
Apparently. I mean. they take better photos or something. I'm not sure. Because don't they breed bulls in a way where the cow doesn't even get to see the bull anymore?
I don't know, Sue.
I think we better ask Gabe.
He's become a nationally renowned speaker because one year they said to him, "This isn't working for us. You are not making any money. There's been several years of drought. This bull thing is great, but it's not your main source of income." So he actually started farming in a completely different way. And what he was doing was rather than farming sustainably, he was farming regeneratively. And it was sort of by fluke and sort of by some planning and sort of by the fact that he needed to do something to remain in the farming business. And I've been after him for years to write a book about it. It finally came out. It's called Dirt to Soil. And it's a really interesting book about how they're regenerating their soil and farming in just a different way. And I think it's kind of the wave of the future. So if you would like to read a North Dakota author and support a local author, I would recommend Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown.
Is this a sort of crop rotation very intentionally?
What they do is they use animals for disturbing the soil. They use cover crops. Soil is always much more microbially fit when you don't disturb what's going on underneath the surface. And that's kind of their theory behind this, is that the buffalo on the Great Plains used to come, they disturbed the soil, they fertilized it inadvertently, and then they left. And then that soil, of course, was regenerated just by their hoof action. And so they're talking about ways that we can bring life back to our soil. And one of the interesting things I read in that book was the fact that no matter how many chemical inputs you've used on land, there still remains the regenerative animals and microbes down there that you need to make your soil beautiful and black.
There is a good TED Talk, and I can't remember the name, but it is on rangeland and how proper range management can make your soil healthier.
It takes a very diverse underground village to make good soil, I take it.
It does, which leads me into the next couple of books that I would recommend, that if you buy a piece of property and you want a garden, but your garden is less than favorable, you know, the soil is clay, or maybe it's rocky, maybe it hasn't been gardened in many, many years. I found a current author, current in as much as I've got two books here. One of them was written in the 70s and sold for like $1.25. And I had to search it out on the internet and paid over $20 for it. And it was called the Ruth Stout No Work Garden Book, Secrets of the Famous Year-Round Mulch Method. And that book kind of reflects Charles Dowding's vegetable garden books that he's written. He's from England, and he writes these great books on how you should actually never till your soil. You should plant into hard ground and then keep it covered. So the current trend is kind of like to investigate all of these other ways to keep our soil healthier. Use compost. You know, rather than throw out your garbage, you want to make that into compost. You can feed your soil that way, and it will feed you back in return. So his book is The Vegetable Garden Diary, No Dig, Healthy soil, fewer weeds. And you can find that, of course, online. Charles Dowding is his name. And he's been gardening for many years, and he's taken absolutely crappy soil. And you should see what his gardens look like. I'm envious, and this is the way I'm going to start gardening at my house.
I've taken a lot of pictures.
Yep, I've kind of always leaned this way, but I've never really, like, trusted it. So what you got to do is you got to throw out all your old thinking here.
Yeah.
But my favorite is little book from the 70s has become the Ruth Stout No Work Garden Book. She's a little old lady that when she pulls her weeds, she just throws them back down on the garden. She never tilled because she was unable to. She once again, when you're forced into a situation where you don't have somebody to help you, you don't own a tiller, she just started planting stuff and laying down the weeds, and she mulches with paper, whatever, buries garbage. But it's a cute little book that a friend of mine, the Podol family that raises Prairie Road Organic Seeds, they've actually been doing Ruth Stout's No Work Garden method since the 70s when they read that book. And you can probably plunge your hand into their soil. It's that wonderful and soft underneath a cover of straw or hay.
And you know what the bonus is here? It's the laziest method that's best.
Absolutely.
Come on.
Absolutely.
Let nature do the work.
That's right. And people are like, oh my gosh, you have all those gardens. You must work constantly. No, I don't. I am the world's laziest gardener, let me tell you. There's a couple weeks in the spring when you got to really go for it. But then after that, you kind of just water it. And people water too much. That's another thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to deep water every 2 to 3 days, depending on whether it rains or not. Because then your plants develop these long roots. And you know where they're growing? They're growing into the wormholes and the old root passages from last year's garden. And so it's just a wonderful symbiotic way to be a lazy gardener, like you said.
Well, let's talk about this. You know, you're part of this movement. Root Cellar Farms outside of Mandan is your business. And there are lots more of these sort of, what would you call them?
Unconventional farmers?
Yeah.
Well, and I've all of the things I do, whether it's cooking or gardening, have been done basically out of laziness. I'm like, yeah, there's got to be an easier way to do this. Like, I don't peel potatoes. I don't peel my carrots. I don't peel my apples. And now they're like, oh, that's where all the good stuff is. I'm like, oh, really? Well, that's great. So with the gardening, I do not own a tiller myself. I have always used raised bed gardening or French intensive gardening methods because when I was a young mother and I didn't have anything else to do, I read organic gardening magazines, like absorbed them. And so I've tried a lot of different things, but like mulching, like these books recommend, is absolutely the greatest thing that I've ever discovered. So whether you're gardening at a community garden plot or whether you've got your own little plot at home, even container gardens should be deeply mulched. And if you want to, I have one last book I'd like to recommend that I just had an afterthought on when I was looking at gardening books. Lisa Hamilton wrote a book called Deeply Rooted, Unconventional Farmers in the Age of Agribusiness. And the reason I would recommend that is because it tells the story of the Podols down in Fullerton and how they have developed their gardens, how they have developed their organic farming methods, how they've used science to make this really work for them. And they just came out with a seed catalog, which I would highly recommend if you're a beginning gardener to purchase seeds from them, because when they say their seeds germinate at 99%, they are spot on, and they were bred for northern climates. So while you're out there admiring that beautiful snowbank that's circling your greenhouse, which I don't know where that snow came from, we have to dig a path out to the greenhouse if we can't get out there pretty soon.
Well, for our listeners, you know, they can take advantage of all of this knowledge you've acquired by reading all of those magazines and books over the years. Sue, how can they tap into your experience?
I would like you to just visit me at therootsellers.com, where you can also access these little tidbits of information that we put on the radio, as well as videos, recipes, and other such things. Ask us some questions. Wouldn't you like your listeners to ask you some questions?
Yes.
We'd be happy to answer. I get that all the time. I hear you on the radio, but we don't hear you. So we'd like to, you know, answer any questions that you might have. But The Root Sellers is SELLERS.com.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
I programmed my own computer.
Hey, kids, explore the power and magic of computer coding with the Minot Public Library and Prairie Public. Join us for a free PBS Scratch Junior training and create fun, interactive stories and games featuring your favorite PBS Kids characters. Hop into the Minot Public Library for this cool coding camp Thursday, March 7th at 2 p.m. Be sure to register for this free event by calling 701-838-0606.
We talk to computers in zeros and ones. That's how programming is done.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Oh, when that holler, that musical holler comes, we know it's time to look at what's happening. Every Thursday we do this. Ashley Thornburg and I look at the calendar of stuff that's out there to intrigue us for the weekend and beyond.
And it's always hard to stop singing that song. It's so catchy.
Yeah, I think that's one of those one-hit wonders, though.
The
nevertheless,
Four Non-Blondes? I think they had more than
well,
that.
Well, it's an earworm for me right now.
All right, how about this Old Friends Concert Friday, the first in Jamestown at the Arts Center. This is a bunch of musicians getting together, playing old school country to rock and blues, a little bit of Cajun, maybe even some Celtic and gospel music to just round out this musical evening from the Old Friends in Jamestown at the Arts Center. This is coming up on Friday the 1st, so tomorrow. Gets going at 7 o'clock, and tickets are $15.
Desserts to Die For, and DIE stands for Destination Imagination. This is Friday in Hunter at the Northern Cass School. Ice cream sundaes and brownie bars will be available after a Northern Cass performance of The Snow Queen. All funds from the event will be going to support the Northern Cass Destination Imagination STEAM education programs. It's from 7:30 to 9 on Friday evening at the Northern Cass School in Hunter, and the cost is $5.
There's a Special Olympics State Basketball Tournament in Minot at the Minot State Dome. This is this weekend, Friday and Saturday, the 1st and 2nd of March. So this has 46 different teams from 10 different cities, more than 400 people who are going to be playing in the Special Olympics State Basketball Tournament. They're always looking for volunteers, especially if you have a working knowledge of basketball, but they will put you to good use if you don't. 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Friday and Saturday in Minot at the Minot State Dome for the Special Olympics State Basketball Tournament, and it's free.
There'll be a benefit for Lena Eichhorn in Fargo at the Grace Lutheran School Saturday. Lena needs a double lung and heart transplant. She's moved to Rochester, Minnesota, where she'll be hospitalized until a donor is found, and she'll have to remain there for the next 3 to 4 months after surgery. The benefit for her includes a turkey meal, a silent auction, a bake sale, and more. All funds raised will go to help the Eichhorn family with their medical and additional expenses. It runs from 11 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon at Grace Lutheran School in Fargo. There's a free will donation if you go.
There is a showing of the film My Country No More coming up tomorrow in Sydney, Montana at the Mondack Heritage Center. We had the filmmaker on Main Street some weeks back for this. Again, it's called My Country No More. And this is a film that is set in North Dakota, specifically in Trenton, as it follows the rise and fall of the oil boom and talks about rural life, ag, energy, people who are using the land for food, people who are trying to use the land to get oil. So there's a lot of consideration in this film. 7 to 8:30 for the film at the Mondack Heritage Center, and it's free.
Living Beyond Bollywood, a one-act play, Saturday in Moorhead at the Emcombe Center. Living Beyond Bollywood offers a performative tour of India, featuring several fictional vignettes staged through the exhibition. The 45-minute play portrays Indian and Indian-American figures from the past, present, and future walking through the audience. And they're also in the midst of an exhibition that's taking place at the Emcombe Center and bringing the Indian immigration experience to life. It'll run from 2 until 3 Saturday afternoon at the Emcombe Center. The cost is $10. It is free for members of the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County.
There's a Scandinavian festival this Sunday in Detroit Lakes at the Ekumens Forest Conference Center. So lots of deep roots here for Scandinavian people in this area. And so you can see Norwegian artifacts and learn about how to make lesa, krumkaka, and much more. Things like handcrafts, like wood carving available as well. 12 to 3 on Sunday the 3rd in Detroit Lakes at the Ekumens Forest Conference Center. And it's free.
Dr. Seuss' birthday party will be celebrated in Fargo Saturday at the Downtown Library. March 2nd is Dr. Seuss's birthday, and the Fargo Public Library, along with the Valley Reading Council, invite all ages to enjoy all things Dr. Seuss at this Seuss-tastic celebration event. This themed program is part of Read Across America Day, and all ages are welcome. Youngsters will enjoy stories, a small craft opportunity, and some snacks. All materials will be provided. Adults must accompany children under age 10. It's 11 o'clock on Saturday at the Downtown Library in Fargo, and it's free.
All right, my pick of the week is tonight. It is a cheese button fest, and so cheese button. I mean, what more do you really need to hear? Those delicious little snacks. This is in Bismarck at the Elks Lodge, and you can choose as the area's best cheese button makers are serving up some of the best cheese buttons. There's also going to be some sausage and German music and trivia, board games and cash bar. This is in Bismarck at the Elks Lodge tonight, 5 to 7:30, and the cost is $14.
A new show opens at Theater B, Blackbird. It will run Thursdays through Sundays until March 23rd. It's in Moorhead at Theater B's new location at 10th Street and 2nd Avenue North. This is a very serious play. The residual effects of child sexual abuse are portrayed in David Harrower's drama when a young woman confronts her childhood abuser 15 years later in the workplace. Hardy Koenig and Crystal Cassette will star. They're two very capable performers. So the play is Blackbird. It runs 7:30 on Thursdays through Saturday with 2 p.m. matinees on a couple of Sundays during that run, which is, again, through March 23rd. And the cost is $25 for tickets. And that's what's happening.
The Minot Chamber Chorale is performing their yearly Winter Classical Masterpiece Concert on Sunday, March 3rd at 3 p.m. in the Anicole Nelson Hall on the campus of Minot State University. This year's concert features the Gabriel Fauré Requiem and Randall Thompson's Testament of Freedom with words by Thomas Jefferson. The concert is free and open to the public. A free will offering will be accepted to help support programming. More information at MinotChamberChorale.org or on the Minot Chamber Chorale's Facebook page.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we spent a second week in conversation with President Thomas Jefferson talking about the Constitution.
Jefferson was not at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, but he was, in a sense, the bibliographer of it, and he had extensive commentary about it once he received finished copies of it in the autumn of 1787 in Paris.
This week we talk about some of the compromises that were necessary for the delegates to make in order to ratify the Constitution.
Two principally, David. First, big states versus little states. That gave us equal representation in the Senate, proportional in the House. And secondly, of course, the original sin of American life, slavery. The can was kicked down the road by the Founding Fathers.
And we also acknowledge that in the end, we as citizens still have the power to change it. So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk about how to keep your heart healthy with Sanford Health cardiologist Thomas Haldus and also exercise physiologist Zeke Reynolds. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 28th. Long before white settlers came to the region, Native tribes farmed, hunted, and worshipped here. While their numbers were small, barely one person per square mile, the different tribes would still come into frequent contact. While sometimes this was for trade or celebration, other times the tribes would clash. Wars could start over stolen horses or hunting ground rights. Once ignited, the animosity could last for generations. While it's near impossible to know when intertribal warfare began, archaeologists have determined from artifacts that fighting extended well into the prehistoric past, continuing until the last of the bison herds were gone in the mid-1880s. Palisades and other fortifications along the Missouri River date back to times before Europeans discovered North America. The people from these villages would be ancestors to the Arikara, Mandan, and Hidatsa, who had their own fair share of tribal warfare before they united. One record of intertribal warfare comes from William Clark's journal entry on this date in 1805. He wrote, "The Arikara express a wish to visit the Mandans and know if it'll be agreeable to them to admit the Arikaras to settle near them and join them against their common enemy, the Sioux. We mentioned this to the Mandans, who observed they had always wished to be at peace and good neighbors with the Arikaras. It is also the sentiments of all the Big Bellies, the Hidatsas, and Sioux nations." So surprisingly, or perhaps unsurprisingly, the Arikara, Mandan, and Hidatsa were already allies before they officially became the three affiliated tribes. Clark goes on to describe conflict between white settlers and the surrounding tribes. Some of the tribes liked the settlers and others did not. Depending on which tribes the settlers liked, they would provide tools of war in exchange for resources like food and blankets. While it may not have been a nice part of history, intertribal warfare is a significant element of the Great Plains narrative. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home, creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
On the next morning edition, a bishop calls for unity after United Methodists vote to maintain a ban on gay marriage and clergy.
This decision has caused a shockwave of trauma across the church and around the world.
And we profile the National Security Council's controversial new hire.
He is a damn good scientist.
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. Friday on Main Street, our monthly Editors Roundtable will take a close look at what's been happening at the legislature. Along with our news director and Capitol mainstay Dave Thompson, this month's special guests are Jack Zaleski, a columnist with Forum Communications, and Tony Bender, who's a columnist and the publisher of the Ashley Tribune and the Wishing Star. We hope you can join us for Main Street and our Editors Roundtable Friday right here on Prairie Public. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.